You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today we are looking at part 5 in our Nicholas Meyer as an author series with Black Orchid, which is a book he co-wrote with Barry J. Kaplan. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we're joined by Matt of Literary Treks and the Orb. How's it going, Matt?
Going really well. How are you guys doing?
We're doing okay.
All right.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, you know, when we started doing all of these books, I'm like, you know, a lot of these things like Black Orchid, it's like no one's ever heard of it or whatever. So I was like, I should get the literary dude from the network to come on and join us. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
So for those people who aren't familiar, you want to tell them what Literary Treks is, and the Orb as well, but I guess Literary Treks in particular.
Of course. Literary Treks is our dedicated podcast on the network of Trek FM to the literary world of Star Trek, whether that's in novel form. We also look at the comics as well. We've looked at I guess you could call it kind of faux history. We just interviewed David Goodman about his 150 years Federation book, which was really fascinating. So we'll be looking as well at kind of the reference books that come out as well. So trying to cover as much as possible there. You know, we don't get to do a lot of audiobooks. Those don't come out much these days, but just something that hadn't been done in the Trek universe, and we felt like it was missing and wanted to do something on it. And I love to read, and I really already read all the Trek books, and so thought, well, let's give this a shot and go for it. And it's been something that a lot of people have liked so far, so I'm really thankful for that.
Yes. I think it's, I mean, in terms of like concepts for, you know, Star Trek related podcasts, it seems like the one that seems most missing until it came about. Because I mean, like, there are tons of Star Trek books, and as a person who really likes Star Trek and looks at those books, I go, I do not want to pick up a random book and start reading it because some of those look really nuts. Like, I need somebody to read them and then say, okay, that one's good. Don't read that one. That one's boring. That's what I need.
Well, and it's, you're right. There's a lot of Star Trek books out there, and it can be very daunting. And the way they're doing them now, they all are very interconnected. You don't have to read every book, but it's helpful when you do. And it's kind of more fun now, of course, when you do. It's like if you were to just watch a little bit of one of the series and then jump to the next series, it's more fulfilling if you watch the whole thing. And so they've done that with the books, and it's made it enjoyable to read them. But you're right. There's been some really bad ones out there. There's been some crazy ones. And so we do try to get a chance as well to talk to the authors and kind of pick their brains about why they were doing something, or get a background on how they do it. And that's really interesting too. So that's been, I think, probably the highlight to me, because I've been reading for a long time, and getting to talk to the authors and see, you know, how they were thinking about a story and why they did something with a character and what they even think about the characters or the series or anything like that is fascinating. Because some of these writers, they've written for the shows, they tried to write for the shows. So yeah, it's been such a blast, and I'm really, really thankful to the Star Trek authors and that community for embracing us and coming on to talk about their work, because without them, we wouldn't be a hit, I don't think.
And you've also started up a new show called The Orb, right? Which is a Deep Space Nine show?
Yeah, we did. Chris and I are huge Deep Space Nine fans. And one of the things that's kind of been lacking out there when it comes to Deep Space Nine podcasts has been a dedicated show, not to just episode reviews or anything like that, but just really talking through the different issues and themes and characters and everything that goes into Deep Space Nine. And, you know, as being a fan of the show and it being my favorite and seeing how much depth there is to it and just kind of layers upon layers you know, peeling it back like an onion. And you can keep doing that with that show, and it really keeps giving to you.
Okay, so Matt, now, seeing as how we're covering Nicholas Meyer in this particular series, what are your thoughts on Nicholas Meyer's Star Trek movies? Star Trek 2, 4, and 6 specifically, I guess.
Well, 6 is my favorite film of all of them, and... you know, 2 is probably my second favorite. And so he's written and been a part of and directed my two favorite Star Trek movies. And I can't think of anybody who's done it better and really gets the character and the spirit of Star Trek, especially for somebody who doesn't necessarily care about Star Trek the way so many other people do. And I think that's really amazing.
So today's book is Black Orchid, which is Nicholas Meyer's fourth novel. Okay, well, here's a basic synopsis. In the late 19th century, Brazil has a monopoly on the rubber industry, and American explorer Harry Kincaid is hired by the British government to steal rubber seeds from Brazil so that they can grow their own rubber trees.
You're making it sound really interesting, Mike.
Sorry.
From the bird's eye view of this, it seems like it would make a really good sim game.
We're gonna call it Rubber Barons.
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading it, I was like, I am much more interested in the economics here than I am in the story.
Well, okay, so Matt, what were your thoughts on the book in general?
Well, you know, it took me a really, really long time to get into this book, and we're talking like 2/3 of the way through it to really all of a sudden it takes this very strange turn. Like, it goes from being kind of a mindless story with way too much of that 70s mentality where we need to over explain everything and give every single detail possible. It's like everybody had to try and be Ian Fleming, where they would give the exact name and date of whatever, you know, Bond was drinking or all those kind of things. And they really pick up on this idea and try to kind of give him a Bondishness to him, but it's not exciting for so long.
Okay. Well, what about you, Max? What was your,
Well, I was describing to this, this to you earlier about how this book was weird because like 100 pages in, I was like, when is this story going to get going? And then another 100 pages in, I was like, is this the story? Is this what it is? And then, like, another 100 pages, and the book was almost over, and I was like, I don't get why this is what's happening.
Like I was saying to you, it's kind of a gear shift movie.
And I was going to ask you on like, what you mean by that, because I did not feel a gear shift. It did not seem to accelerate at any point. I didn't feel us going to reverse at any moment.
Well, it's divided into two parts, you know, and the first part is very sort of like you're saying, maneuvering, getting pieces into place, establishing who the players are in this world and, mm-hmm. and what the stakes are and everything like that. And it's going in such a way that you know, basically what they're trying to do is steal rubber seeds so that they can plant their own trees, mm-hmm. so that they're not dependent on, you know, the rubber barons in Brazil for their rubber.
It's just interesting that this very large scale political scheme involved the stealing of seeds.
Oh, I know. That's the thing is, like, I'm reading this, and I'm like, you know, there's a lot of like actually parallels to like Indiana Jones going on here, and
in the Temple of Doom.
In the Temple of Doom,
it reminds
exactly.
me of the Temple of Doom. In fact, his character reminds me of the Temple of Doom as well, because, you know, Indian, the Temple of Doom, is a very selfish, self-absorbed character who could care less about anybody else, honestly.
Yeah.
And it's only in his later films he kind of grows as a character to care about other people.
This
and
is
not
my
just
thing.
The
this is my
prize
thing.
That he's going after.
Have you listened to the Temple of Doom commentary recorded? Because that is exactly what I say, and everyone thinks I'm crazy.
No, you're completely right on. What my point, though, is that the character learns. And so this mm-hmm. character right here, what's interesting is you think that, at least from the beginning, you think he's Indiana Jones from the Temple of Doom. Who he really is, by the end of the book, is Indiana Jones from The Last Crusade.
Well, it's kind of the arc of Temple of Doom.
Maybe a much creepier Indiana Jones.
No, I mean, exactly. It is
very
really
similar
creepy.
To the arc from Temple of Doom, where he's in it for fortune and glory, he's in it for the money, and then he realizes that there's something more at stake.
Yeah, but he still never stops being kind of unappealing and gross.
Right.
Well, maybe. In terms of the character's arc, you know, within the unappealing and grossness,
Unfortunately, what happens here, too, is they are spending so much time setting up this chessboard in the beginning so that all the pieces can move kind of very quickly by the end.
Yeah.
But the setup is so boring. I mean, it's worse than watching a chess game.
Well, I don't know. I think I was I thought more favorably of the book than you guys did.
I'm not going to say that it was. I don't think that the pieces were boring necessarily. Like, my problem was that, like, there are a lot of pieces in this particular board, mm-hmm. and none of them seem very clear.
No, I mean, I didn't have a problem with that. I mean, the big problem that I had with the book is what Matt was saying about it being overly descriptive and stuff. I mean, there's a good book in here that, is about 50 pages shorter than what we actually got,
I think maybe more description towards the end of the book and a lot less towards the beginning.
Perhaps.
That might solve the problem.
Perhaps.
Because the end of the book happens way too fast.
It does. It happens really quickly. And some really, really weird things happen, too.
Yes.
I mean, just things I didn't really want to read about, but now they're always in my brain.
I don't know. Like, to me, in terms of it being a gear shift thing, like I was saying, the first half of the book, part one,
a little bit more than half.
Yeah, part one of the book is this sort of, all of these chess pieces coming into play and stuff like that. And, there is a momentum. You do think that it's going in a certain direction. And then.
Do you?
When I do, yeah. And
I
then,
didn't.
And then when the sort of, I don't know, part two's inciting incident happens at the end of part one, it does change and then become a race, a race down the Amazon. And I guess there's you always know that it is going to come into play at some point because they keep on making a big deal about
the
Amazon River itself. And I mean, even the first, the prologue is just like, this is the Amazon River. It's gonna mess you up, and you don't.
It's
really...
Crystal Skull, but backwards. They're going the opposite direction,
right?
Yes,
and you don't even really see. They don't talk about it. You don't see it anything like that for the entire first part, and then it becomes the thing in the second part. But I did like it on the whole. Once I got I can't say that I really enjoyed reading it. But once I finished it, I was like, "Oh, I'm glad that I read it. That was an interesting story. That was an interesting subject."
The kind of social commentary that it was doing on the time period was relatively interesting. And just not knowing anything about this part of the world at that time and what was going on with the way the natives were being used, just basically as slaves and all that, I thought that was actually pretty interesting. And a good part of the story, the part that enabled me to kind of really get in, and I felt like when they finally went with that a little bit more, I was more engaged with the story for sure.
I didn't really know anything about the history, the real life history of this era in Brazil. So I did some research, and by that I mean I went on to Wikipedia, if that counts. But just to give people sort of a little bit of historical background as to the world that this takes place in, this is a fictional story. It's based on historical fact. Like they have a little thing at the beginning, at the very beginning of the book, where they say, like, look, we know that this isn't real.
It's the disclaimer that you put in front of anything that's loosely based on real events.
Right. They say,
I changed things around so that you can't sue me. That's the end of the statement.
Yeah, well, they also say, like, this isn't how events occurred. It's how we thought they should occur. But, as far as what actually happened, the Brazilian rubber boom lasted from 1879 to 1912, where basically what happened was, with the introduction of automobiles and everything, the need for rubber wheels and all sorts of other stuff, this is where the rubber was naturally being grown, and you know, these people just cleaned up. So rubber barons, you know, from Europe and elsewhere colonized Brazil and just, you know, took over and basically enslaved the indigenous population in order to harvest the rubber.
But I mean, that's not, that's, the relationship is so ubiquitous throughout history. I mean, like, it's, I mean, it's true of bananas.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it got really bad at
this point. It got really bad everywhere.
Well, sure.
It's still happening.
Well, yeah.
Shell is still actually doing these things today, right now. Some tribe is being wiped out for oil.
Now, the character of Kincaid is pretty much based on this guy named Henry Wickham, who was an explorer. I think he was British. And he smuggled out 70,000 seeds from Brazil in 1876. And they you know, they did this, you know.
Try making a spy movie out of that story.
Well, you know,
I've got the seeds. The seeds for the plants that we're going to grow? Yeah, I stole those seeds for king and country.
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, like, when you see that you got this guy who's like Indiana Jones or James Bond or whatever, and like their big, like, undercover, you know, espionage mission is to run around a field in the middle of the night listening for popping and then run and pick up seeds and put them in dirt. But Wickham, even his story, which was true, you know, I guess he tried to play it up a lot more than what actually happened. You know, he talked later on, because it was a covert operation. He did smuggle out these seeds, you know, but it was in 1876. This was actually 3 years before the rubber boom, and it wasn't illegal to export seeds at that time.
Right.
So, you know, he did it, and he didn't draw attention to himself. He, you know, did it on the sly, but he wasn't doing anything illegal, and it probably wasn't that great of a feat. But later on, he didn't actually say that he did this until after, you know, the rubber plants were growing and wherever, you know, England had them growing. And he's like, oh yeah, I totally did that. I broke up the rubber monopoly and it was a big deal and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I guess historians have gone back and looked at it and they're like, it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, he went in and did it, and, you know, but it's not like it was some sort of great feat at the time. And, it just took, you know, even though this happened before the rubber boom, it took, you know, like 30 years or whatever for the rubber trees to grow to a point where they could actually utilize them.
And by that point, we could synthesize it.
Yeah. So, that's what Kincaid's character was.
Take that,
on.
Nature. Making our own rubber these days. Look at
we
nature.
We don't need you.
It's all pathetic.
Keep your trees in the Amazon.
Oh, yeah, right. We don't need those trees. Ridiculous trees. Yeah. Bouncing around into each other. Because they're made of rubber.
Gotcha. So Kincaid's character is based on Wickham, although obviously a much more sensationalized version of him, I guess.
If this is the sensationalized version, I hate to think how boring this real dude was.
So, in terms of where this fits into Meyer's career, it was published in 1977, which was a year after the West End Horror, and 2 years before his first movie, Time After Time. And so this was really like sort of the last book that he wrote before making the jump into movies. It was co-written by a guy named Barry J. Kaplan, who I haven't really been able to find out much info on. It sounds like primarily he's a playwright. He's written some novels too. He went to college with Meyer at University of Iowa, and that's where they knew each other from. I guess they were friends. And the only other thing that I know about him is that while he was at Iowa, he studied under Kurt Vonnegut Jr. As far as like stylistic differences between this and his other books, you know, this is the only book which isn't told in first person out of all of Meyer's novels, which I think you kind of need to do because of the type of story that it is. There's so many sides, so many people which you're maneuvering that...
He also kind of cheats a little bit here and there with the narrative. I mean, because he does play fast and loose with the whole concept of first versus third person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's very much like looking at what the people are.
Like he has written third person narratives, like coming from a second person told to the first person.
But it's definitely not at all like any of his other books in terms of the style. I'm wondering how much of an influence Kaplan had on that. Same thing with the description. You know, I mean, we talked about how it's overly descriptive, and his other movies are not like that. His other movies?
Books. You books, said movies
books
twice.
And movies. Books and movies.
This
though.
Is like a recurring thing.
It is a recurring thing, but he's a really good editor. You know, he knows how to pace a story, whether it's on film or in a book. And I'm wondering how much of Kaplan's, you know, influence was there to sort of like bring it down to this level.
I do think, though, you're definitely right, because this doesn't fit in with especially what we know or see of him in Star Trek, where, you know, he edits and cuts things down to the bare minimum, so you just get all the information you need without anything really extraneous.
Yeah.
This book is just full of extraneous things, and I think that's one of the things that surprised me in reading it, because I was kind of expecting a tighter, kind of cleaner story, and that's not what happens.
Right. Right. I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to see Kaplan's other work and see if it more closely mimicked this. Or
I think that the difference in style is probably a result of the content. I mean, like, this story would fit with this style better than the other way around. If this was written like one of his Sherlock Holmes pastiches, then it would be a very different thing. Like, those are very... they're essentially like structured around a sensational concept packaged in a banal title and you know, allowed for various weird little like entry points. This doesn't have that. This is much more along the lines of like, you know, an old school dense, like monolithic, like prose novel. It establishes tons of texture, characters, world, interactions, connections, and then it deals with, you know, the actions of an individual in that society, that situation, that world, and the ramifications of that action. So, like, it's a distinctly different story structure than his other works. So you can't say that, like, the style is the difference. The style is the result of that story.
The style also seemed to kind of fit a little bit of the kind of that time period that he's writing in a way you kind of read when you read a Ludlum novel, very overly descriptive. And a lot of writers were doing that at that time period. And so it seems to just fit that, you know, 70s, 80s novel form.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought of that because I guess I haven't really read all that much stuff from that era. But I mean, what you were saying about, like, it being similar to Fleming, I could see that. Yeah, I mean, the difference is that I think Fleming is, like you were inferring, I think, a lot better at it, you know, where... you know, it adds so much texture to the characters and everything and to the world when Fleming does that, whereas this is just extraneous detail.
Well, and Fleming knows when to not do that. And he also felt like knew how to edit so that the books, I mean, Bond books are very short, very short. And so, yeah, this just felt overly long because there's just too much detail.
Yeah. I mean, just a few other like little weird things. It's his first non-detective.
Also, nothing to do with orchids.
Nothing. Not much to do with orchids. No.
Yeah. Very misleading title.
He loves misleading titles.
Yeah. Yeah. Even in his movies. Yeah.
His next book is called "Pictures of Your Mom Naked."
Although I don't know if "The Wrath of Khan" was very misleading.
Yeah, that's true. But he wanted to call it "The Undiscovered Country."
Yeah.
Ah.
So.
Well, I'm glad he finally got to do that because I think it fits better in 6 than it does with 2.
This is true. Yes.
It still doesn't really seem to fit.
Well, no. Okay, hold on, because I'm going to defend this to my dying breath. The Undiscovered Country, the way it's used in the movie, takes that play off of Shakespeare, but they change Undiscovered Country from being death to being the unknown, the thing that you're most fearful of. Well, we're most fearful of death, but in the Star Trek world, we're most fearful of giving up what we've done for so long, which is Kirk giving up his anger against the Klingons giving up their hatred towards the Federation. These are all things that are so fearful we'd almost rather continue on in wars we can't afford anymore and will kill us because it's so scary. It's as scary as death. It's the Undiscovered Country. So when you... I think it fits very well with the motif that Meyer is going for in that film of, you know, what Spock talks about. You're going to let go. You're going to realize that the universe will unfold as it should. You have faith. That's what that whole movie is about. And it's almost in some ways un-Star Trekian, if that's a term, because it's a lot about having faith in the universe and that it should unfold and things should change and grow and be new. And that's the undiscovered country.
Just one last thing here, you know, the in terms of sort of bringing it back to Star Trek, the chase down the Amazon in part two of the book had a lot of similarities to Wrath of Khan, the nebula battle in Wrath of Khan. You know, there was like the maneuvering, outthinking your opponent. I mean, the colonel was very similar to Khan in a lot of ways, and then it even
both start with a K sound.
They do, and you know when Kincaid, you know, takes his boat into the marshy lands or whatever, you know, the colonel's first officer is saying, like, we can't go in there. That, you know, our shields would be useless. And then
that's what he says.
He says, like, you know,
that's the line that he uses.
Full power ahead. And then basically
Scotty's like, I can't get that much power out of her.
Yeah. And basically the colonel, Khan, like, kills himself, destroys his boat, destroys his everything in the pursuit.
He detonates the Genesis seeds.
Right. In pursuit
for everything that they stand for.
Yeah. Yep.
Uncool.
all in pursuit of Kincaid, Kirk, you know?
Yeah.
Anyone
also
else
starts
that?
With a K. No, I know what you're saying.
Okay.
It's crazy.
I'm just saying. I'm not saying that like he was like, oh man, I'm going to use this thing from this book that no one read. I'm just saying that, like, you know, it's there.
Nobody
there certain
liked it when it was in the Amazon, but maybe they'll like it when it's in space.
Just like when you're watching a Michael Bay movie and you see similarities, you know,
like the same shots used a few times.
Yeah, just with Transformers digitally added to them,
yeah,
literally. But I mean, I can see it being the same sort of thing. You know, I mean, I don't know.
What I see is that it's conceptually difficult to imagine a naval battle in general. And considering that Star Trek has essentially naval battles in space, if you've got a good idea for a naval battle, that's kind of a really bizarre thing to have in your head, period.
Yeah.
So you might end up using it more than once.
That could be.
I did notice, though, that Kincaid is facing some of the same issues that Kirk is in 2 and 6, that kind of idea of he's getting old, he's not really sure if he likes his life, if he's good at it anymore, if he's worthy of it anymore, all those kind of issues Kincaid deals with at the beginning of this book, and just not having that unease of age kind of taking away your vitality. And Kincaid goes through that a couple of times in this book, especially when he's tired out during some, shall we say, sexy times. And he's disappointed because, you know, he used to be able to go all night. So some of these issues, you know, you get picked up with Kirk specifically, and especially Star Trek II.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Kincaid gets a lot of that energy back when he hooks up with an extremely young girl.
That's
as
true.
You
Let's
do.
Not talk about the blood.
Yes.
I didn't bring it up. Someone else did.
So, any final thoughts on Black Orchid? Matt?
Well, you know, I would say that if you are semi-interested in seeing what Nicholas Meyer is like outside of his Star Trek work, I would probably, from listening to y'all, I would stick with the Holmes books. You know, if you're really interested and you kind of want to see a few things that remind you of Kirk or whatnot, you know, find it on Amazon for, you know, a few cents and pick it up. But otherwise, I don't know if it's worth somebody trying to seek out. I just think it's too overly descriptive, and the payoff at the end is just, it's just not quite worth it, especially of what I come to expect from Nicholas Meyer in his film work, and obviously specifically Star Trek. I feel like all of his films pay off very well. You're never upset that you've watched one of them. I could almost be sorry I might have read this book.
So what were your thoughts on it, Max?
For a book called Black Orchid, not nearly enough botany. I wanted to hear more about plants.
There was a lot.
I am lying. Okay. There was too much botany in this book. But
too much botany, not enough Botany Bay. Sorry. I apologize.
That is, you're a terrible person for that joke. I hope that was not recorded.
It was recorded. I apologize.
Okay, fine. Well, yeah, but I mean, like, this book, I don't want him to make a sequel to this. I don't want him to follow up. I don't want to see, you know, Kincaid goes on the Nile for an adventure where he steals sand seeds.
He goes on the Yangtze Kien. Are you sure you don't want to see that one?
The runabout?
No. The river.
Yeah. I don't particularly find that subject interesting.
Oh, well. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, I definitely think that so far out of the Meyer novels that we've read, this one is his worst. But I still thought it was good.
But if he did a series of these where Kincaid was like his Snake Plissken, mm-hmm. but specifically for stealing seeds.
Yeah.
Kind of awesome.
I'd have to read at least one more. I mean, just to see what it was like, you know? I mean, just to see what it was like. So, Matt, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Trek FM. Of course, I also do the book reviews there, so you'll be able to find my book reviews of usually the latest Star Trek novels at the beginning of the month, usually the first or second week. And then you can follow me on Twitter at MattRushing02. And I don't usually mention this, but this is a different place. And so I also have my own blog, which is just my own personal blog. And it's 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And I just write about all sorts of different things there. And so that's just kind of my personal place to be able to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And so if you're interested, let me know.
Cool.
That's good. I would just like to request you should do a absolute best of episode where you cover the best Star Trek novels, because I would like to know that. I'd like to have a primer on that, so I do not have the fortitude to just venture into this world.
Well, I will plug then. Colin had us on Trek News and Fuse back before Christmas, I think it was. He had me and Michael Clark and Cena mm-hmm. from the 10 Forward podcast. And we did do that. We talked kind of the best of books. So that's a good place to start. We kind of talked about some of our favorites.
Was that Literary Holodecks?
Yeah, I think that's what Colin called the episode.
Yeah, that's
Literary
Holodecks. Yeah, I remember the name of the episode. Yeah, I remember the name of another person's episode.
Good job.
Excellent.
Well, as always, you can find us on our other podcast, commentarytrackstars.com, or you can find us on Twitter at comtrackstars or email comtrackstars@gmail.com.
Oh, God.
Or also, now, you can find all three of us on the new Trek.fm forums, which are a fun place to hang out and give us feedback and talk about other things. So look for that on Trek.fm. Thank you very much for joining us again, Matt. Thank you again very much for joining us, Matt.
Thanks, Matt, for the joining of us.
I'm so glad that I could help you two join. I'm going to go now and let y'all continue joining alone.
We'll be back next week with part 6 in our look at Nicholas Meyer as an author, where we cover Confessions of a Homing Pigeon.